Dr. Rebecca Mercury is internationally recognized as an expert on electronic voting systems. She has much to say about voting and the implementation of voting technology.
There are many states where what they do is provide you with the paper ballot and you put the dots in where, you know, or X's or whatever they tell you to do on your selection. And then very few places count them manually, but again, the paper would be available for a manual counting, but then it's usually scanned. But that is a voter verified paper ballot. It's a paper ballot that you verified by virtue of you making the selections in there. But they also say, the excuse I hear from election officials is that, well, it would be very expensive for us to print out all those ballots. I said, but you're printing them out anyway. Every person is getting a printed paper ballot. So why is it any more or less expensive? You know, the quantity of paper is identical because whether you're voting absentee or you're voting in person, you're getting a paper ballot. So why not just print it out? But again, this is part of, you know, I refer to it as the charade. It's the charade of voting. The idea is that we want to make everyone feel that they voted and feel that their vote was counted and that it's available for a recount in those places that want to be able to do that.
Hey everybody, welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski, one of your co-hosts, and I'm joined by Scoop Sweeney and also Wendy Grossman. So you got three co-hosts today, and we have an esteemed guest, Dr. Rebecca Mercury, who's a computer scientist who specializes in computer security and forensics, and she knows a whole lot about computer systems for elections. So I'm handing it off now to Wendy to get the ball rolling.
Okay, well, I think the first time I heard of Rebecca, it was the summer of the year 2000, and Dave Farber published on his mailing list the news that there was this dissertation coming out of the University of Pennsylvania about election security, the security of voting machines. And, you know, I sort of noted it down because it was interesting and it was new and different. And then, of course, a few months later, everything blew up with Bush versus Gore. And I think we must have met, I don't remember how we actually met, whether it was at Computers Freedom and Privacy or whether we did a phone call or what, but we talked quite a bit about online voting. And it's interesting to me that for the last couple of years, we haven't heard so much about shifting to online voting. I think the message that it can't be secured, which was really the main point of Rebecca's thesis, has kind of gotten through somewhat more than it had earlier. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this, but...
Well, I could jump in at any point.
Jump in.
Okay, so I like that description. Actually, he was one of my dissertation advisors.
Dave Farber was.
Right. He was one of there's five dissertation advisors at UPenn in the engineering school, and he was one of them. I had also taken a class with him along the way in my PhD studies. So, but the interesting thing is that actually, I don't think I ever knew that he broadcast that there was this dissertation coming out. So what actually happened, he had probably been reading the early drafts because I had to distribute those to the professors. And also my outside advisor was Peter Neumann, who I had written a number of papers with.
It was possible it was Peter Neumann's list.
Right. You probably read it in Risks. Yeah, in his Risks posting. It possibly was that. So it was a very peculiar thing that was happening. I was really, my real goal was to try to have my PhD you know, the actual diploma, say 2000. But in fact, I wasn't able to complete the dissertation by the, so I defended in October, at the end of October. And then if they pass you, then you, you know, you work on any revisions they want, and then give them to the margin checker lady. And then you'll get, you know, they'll say, okay, you graduate. So everybody has to sign off on it. So what happened was, and I think this is an important part of the story. So oh, by the way, the dissertation title is Electronic Vote Tabulation Checks and Balances. And so the idea was, in my writing of the dissertation, I was actually going to the Common Criteria, which was a 600-page document that was intended for military, any type of secure usages, things like that. I actually had to read the entire 600 pages, which I forced myself to do like 20 pages at a time. And I synopsized it down into 30 pages of what were the critical things with regard to security. And so then as part of this dissertation, I was explaining that there is really nothing in the Common Criteria or even in any types of criteria for computer security at that time, or even since, that could deal with something that needed to be private. So you couldn't actually see what was going on. Like it was, you know, something that you couldn't actually see the votes as they were coming in or anything like that. And the idea being that, okay, so the computer itself, you know, the voting machine itself could be secure, but you don't know if there was software in there that if the person who was typing their things on the screen or, you know, pressing the buttons or whatever, you don't know if there was a trigger in it that you could, you know, press three times over here and two times over here, and then it would actually flip votes. And so that's what I was trying to demonstrate. There's a very famous paper by Ken Thompson, and it was his Turing Award back before Google offered $1 million for when he got the Turing Award. So you got nothing, just a speech and an article in Communications, the ACM, and a dinner where you would give this speech. So Ken Thompson, and this is a very critical thing. It's very short. And what he was showing in this was that he even says in it, you can't trust something you didn't write yourself, even if it was something written by somebody like me. In other words, you know, like a super guru in computer science.
That would be an amusing way to hold elections, though. Get every voter to write their own code.
To write their own. Exactly. So what was interesting to me about that paper, which I was very aware of, I think it was like a 1985 or, you know, around the mid 80s. So it had been around for a really long time. But I was relying on it because the importance was that as these things are getting more and more complex, how can you even trust what is actually going on inside of them? You can't really. And so what I was trying to explain was, and again, it's much more eloquent. You can download it from, it's free on my website. So notablesoftware.com, and you can just look in there for my dissertation. But basically what I was trying to explain was the fact that if you don't, even if you have the code, it still doesn't save you from any problems, because it could be in the operating system, it could be in a whole host of other things. And so the code itself is not necessarily sufficient in order to secure votes that are being tallied on a computer.
And I've had those arguments sometimes with free software types who say, oh, well, but free software solves it because you can read the code. And you sort of go, well,
no. And I've had that argument with various of them people as well. Richard Stallman, who, you know, I know very well, he agrees with me. He you know, was assured that, you know, what I'm saying about this is correct. Now, remember, this was, I defended this dissertation 11 days before the Bush versus Gore election in 2000. Okay. Right. So that's also a critical part of this. So I'll basically at UPenn and probably at many other schools, you deliver your dissertation defense, and then they chuck everybody out of the room except for the advisors. And then it's just you and them sort of slugging it out. And so there was, even though they all knew I had written this and had read it and everything, there was this big debate over whether cryptography could actually be used to secure the election somehow. And what I was saying was you needed to have not a paper trail, paper ballots. If there were paper ballots, even if the computer printed them out, then the paper ballots, the word ballot is important because that means that it is the official version of your vote for purposes of vote counting. So if there's a paper ballot and the voter verifies the paper ballot, then if that's what's being counted, what the voter verified, even if it were generated by a computer, but it has to have been onto a piece of paper, then what I was saying is it would be okay if the ballots could be created by a touchscreen machine. But no, unfortunately, a lot of what has happened since, and also what I was arguing, was that my phrase, voter verified ED, paper ballot, has been changed to voter verifiable paper ballot, and even worse, voter verifiable paper audit trail. And what does audit trail mean? It has no legal sense in terms of a ballot. A ballot does have a legal sense and is, you know, is respected by judges and, you know, when litigation occurs over ballots. But an audit trail is just some nonsense. So people have perverted, they were perverting my phrase even before my dissertation, and they continue to pervert it even now into those variations and some others as well. And so what I've tried to say all along, and including in this dissertation, was that you needed to print it out. But the question on the floor for the five dissertation advisors was to me that I had to see if cryptography would actually be a way to secure the ballot. Okay, now again, that debate continues to rage even to this day as well.
I remember it was a couple of years after that. I remember David Chaum, who he was very technical early. He came up with the first version of electronic cash.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And he's made a fortune in this.
The thing about Chaum, I remember him demonstrating, he had this wonderful idea for a ballot you could verify, and the user got half, and the district got half, and you could match them up and cryptographically, and you could see this pattern. And I'm sitting thinking, this doesn't work because nobody is ever going to understand it.
Right. Exactly.
You can't explain to somebody why this verifies their ballot.
Right. Right. Among other reasons. But he's right in that system does secure
it. Oh, it works.
But
it works.
Nobody understands it. Then how can you prove the software that was even
exactly
correct? You
know, I live
well,
in
does it work at scale?
That's right. It's
certain. Can you scale it?
Yes. If you scale
it,
the number of Sean's.
I live in the UK, and the ballots here are these tiny pieces of paper, and you have a stubby little pencil, and you check a box, and you fold up the paper, and you put it in the ballot box, and that's it. But the thing is, they only ever have one election at a time.
Correct. Just
it's
one.
It's not like the US where you know, like I've been in San Francisco before an election, and you've got like this phone book worth of guidances to all these different elections they're having at the time. And then there's propositions and referenda, and it's, you know, you just don't get that here. It's one thing at a time.
Right, right. So getting back to the story, all that's really great. I'm glad you mentioned Chaum. I would have mentioned him myself, but that was a perfect segue. But getting back to this dissertation and why what next happened is very important. So basically, this large argument ensued. Then they send you out into a side room, but it was close enough nearby. I could hear them screaming at each other from down the hall. So I was like, okay, whatever. Maybe, you know, maybe I will not get a PhD. So then finally one of them comes in and says, okay, come back to the room. So I go in and they said, all right, we're in agreement with what you've written in your dissertation, but you have to do one other thing. We need you to contact, Bruce Schneier. Sorry for a second there. Bruce Schneier, we need you to contact Bruce Schneier to see if he agrees with you about this whole thing about the cryptography. And if he does, then we'll sign the dissertation. If he doesn't, then we'll have to figure out what to do. Okay.
Right. And Bruce was and is a well-known security writer.
Right. And has written the Bible of cryptography. It's like this thick. So, and he also has every Wednesday, he has the cryptogram. So this is always on the 15th of the month. He has the cryptogram. So what happens is that now there's this election coming up. So I've defended this dissertation, but I'm very involved with elections and I had some duties to, you know, some responsibilities and just was interested in it anyway. So I sort of put the whole dissertation on hold and then, you know, the election came. So I worked at the polls and then in the evening we went to Princeton. There was a big party for one of the fellows who was running for Congress. So by the name of Rush Holt, he comes into play as well because he was one of the people who spearheaded the Help America Vote Act. That's a whole different story for another interview. But in any event, I was there watching the television with everybody to see as they were rolling out, you know, who they thought won, you know, how the numbers were going with the different candidates. And Florida, everything was up on the screen, the different states, and you could see them in their various colors. And Florida, all of a sudden, they had Florida sort of blinking and it turned yellow. And then they said, Florida's too close to call. So that was when I got up and I said, well, that's it. I'm going home. And people were saying, why don't you want to see how it turns out? I said, no, the election is not going to be decided until tomorrow or maybe not for a week. Because knowing Florida as well as I had, because I'd been down there on other election things, I knew that this was not a good sign. So the week goes by and I'm, you know, so people are telling me, you have all this information, you need to fax it to the news bureaus. Well, back in that day, people did have fax machines. I had one myself, but I thought, you know, I better put up a website. So I put up a website about my feelings about Florida, because I knew they had the hanging chad and all that sort of stuff, along with other things. So I put up this website, and by the time it went up, it was Friday evening. Within 15 minutes of that website being launched, Associated Press called me and they're like, are you Rebecca Mercury? I said, yes. So conversation ensued. They wanted to interview me. They were going to put it in Saturday night's paper or Saturday night's releases, which meant that everybody would get the Sunday paper again. That was a thing people did back in the day, would be reading this interview with me. So all of a sudden my name was commonplace. I wound up getting called to testify in Bush versus Gore. That's another long story, which I won't get into, but some of it is actually in the last chapter of my dissertation because I still didn't have time to write the rest of the dissertation. So, but I also needed to call Bruce Schneier. So, okay. So time is going on. It's another week and a half. And guess what? Bruce Schneier's cryptogram shows up. So people are all of a sudden calling me and emailing me, Rebecca, you got to read Bruce Schneier's cryptogram. So basically what happened was Bruce Schneier, not knowing anything about my dissertation since I hadn't called him yet, writes this whole lengthy thing about how computers are problematic in elections and blah, 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 blah. And down at the very bottom, the very last sentence says something like, and by the way, the very best person whose materials you should read on this subject is Rebecca Mercury's. So basically, I didn't have to call him. There was no need to call him. He had put it in the cryptogram. So I clipped out the entire cryptogram and I put in an email message and I sent it to the five thesis advisors with the subject line, "Will this suffice?" So basically what happened was they said, okay, yes, Rebecca. So, but by then it was too late to deposit the dissertation. So I wound up adding an extra chapter, which included references to my dissertation and explaining, and also listed the testimony that I had delivered by request of the Gore team in Bush versus Gore, and which was actually footnoted in the materials that were the rulings that were eventually came down from the U.S. Supreme Court. So there was a lot of really important stuff that happened. I mean, it was all very coincidental. But the bottom line is that cryptography then and even still now is not sufficient. And what we're seeing right now is this wave of voting machines, which again are called verifiable or whatever. Then they print out these ballots, and I'm a poll worker. I signed up as I couldn't do it for a while because everybody knew me and they're like, oh, you can't let Rebecca Mercury in there during the election. But now they don't know me again. So I've been a poll worker for a couple of years now in New Jersey. Again, I had done it before, but I watched them. Here in some parts of New Jersey and all over the country, they have these touchscreen machines where they show you a ballot that looks like the ballot that's going to print out, and it will print out, and they show you it, and then you tap on it to select your votes. And then when you're done, you say, okay, done. And then it shows you what your ballot will look like on the screen. And then you have to again confirm it again. And then it shoots it out on a piece of paper on a printer that's around your knees. And when you're a poll worker, you can see them in the booth because there's like a curtain behind them. But you can't actually, oops, sorry about that. You can't actually, you can't see what they're doing, but when they get that paper, you see their hand go down because it's like at their knees, and they pull out the paper while they're leaving the booth. And I can tell you for a fact, because I've been there for days, you know, days at a time, but I've been there numerous days watching hundreds and hundreds of people doing this. And it is very rare when a person picks up that ballot and actually looks at it to check the paper ballot. They're told on the screen to take it over and deposit it into what we fondly refer to as the shredder, but it's a scanner.
Jersey, so in New Jersey, they're counting paper ballots.
They're counting, well, they're not counting them. The person puts them into a scanner, and the scanner is counting them. And then the scanner is going to, at the end of the day, print out this long strip of paper with all the candidates' names on it and how many votes they got for each of the candidates.
And so if you have to conduct a recount or something, you just go and check the numbers on the back of that machine, or do you actually go and recount the ballot?
The issue is that theoretically, and I've never heard of it happening, but theoretically, someone who's complaining about it could call for, there is a big bag that's collecting all the paper that goes in, and then we have to, you know, assemble it into, you know, this locked box and stuff like that at the end of the day, and then it goes back to election headquarters. So they could be, if a judge ruled it, there it would have to be a judge, they could be manually counted. But the point that I'm making is that they never look at it, and in fact they're deliberately never instructed to look at it. In the sample ballot that every New Jersey voter gets just before the election, so they can look at the layout and stuff like that, it's similar, but not exactly the same as the real ballot. It has 8 points of instructions, but they, at the end, it just says, take your paper ballot and deposit it into the scanner. They never tell you to verify it. That's the important part, is the verification, voter verification.
How many states use the same system as New Jersey?
I do not currently know, but I know that there are numerous other states. Not all of New Jersey uses it. The different counties can choose which ones they want, but many of them have it. And the ones that have
That's what we had here in Texas.
You had the same thing?
We had the same thing in Texas, and I did verify my ballot.
And you did verify your ballot, but
I did, yeah.
If you received instructions, my understanding is that the instructions are the same that's being sent out, because the instructions are made by the vendor, you know, the supplier of the voting systems, and they all have the "you should check it." It leaves out that critical step.
It didn't. There was nothing to tell me to verify it, but it just seemed obvious to me that I should look at it.
That you should, but it's not obvious to most people. And again, sitting there watching them do it, if even 2 or 3 out of 100 actually pull it out and look at it, I would be surprised, because I don't actually count every single human that goes in there because I'm doing other tasks. But I have seen hundreds of them. Sometimes I'm there actually sitting right by the machine, and there I can actually see that they just take it and go and drop it into the scanner. So
let's say one person
intentional. I believe this is intentional.
Let's say one person looks at theirs and they see that it's wrong. And you only have one person who says that theirs is wrong, but doesn't that kind of throw the whole thing into doubt?
That is a perfect example, and in fact leads me to the next comment that I was going to make, which is, as a poll worker, they have us come in for training. And part of our training is actually to cast a ballot on, you know, one of these machines, and they make it up like it's, you know, Kennedy versus Nixon, or, you know, they just pick silly things like, you know, Lincoln and, you know, other, you know, it's just silly things. So basically, you know, you select a few of these and then you do this. So of course, during that, I did look at my paper ballot, and there was another person who was doing it at the machine next to me, and he pulls his out and he says, "That's not how I voted." So I was like, "Oh, good. I really want to hear this." Now, I wish it had been me, because then I could say that I voted this way, but unfortunately it wasn't. It was this guy. But I have to trust him. Why would he want to get into this argument? So he and I was sort of trailing behind him, go over to the woman who was running this session. She was like sort of the head guru of training us. There was quite a number of people there. And he tells her this, and she goes, "Oh, don't worry. This is just fake. This is not the real thing." He goes, but it printed out wrong, not the way I had." And she goes, "But don't worry about that. It'll be fine at the election." So that, I mean, again, I just happened to see that and watch that whole scenario, which proved to me that, yes, it is possible that this could happen. It is possible that it happened to this guy in the room where I was doing the training. But again, I have no way of proving that, unfortunately. But I do believe that. I believe that there are ways possibly to even trigger it by doing taps on a screen or whatever. Or, you know, there's possible ways to trigger it. It could possibly do it incorrectly. And then it throws the whole election into doubt. I agree with you.
You know, after the 2020 election, there was much ado about the voting machines. It was horrible in some places, and it was great in others. After this recent election, not so much being said. Why do you think that is? Is it just because the other guy won this time?
No, my feeling about this is that people, unfortunately, have become rather complacent about this stuff. Nobody wants to go back to the hanging chad. There are many states where what they do is provide you with the paper ballot and you put the dots in where, you know, or X's or whatever they tell you to do on your selection. And then very few places count them manually. But again, the paper would be available for a manual counting, but then it's usually scanned. But that is a voter verified paper ballot. It's a paper ballot that you verified by virtue of you making the selections in there. But they also say, the excuse I hear from election officials is that, well, it would be very expensive for us to print out all those ballots. I said, but you're printing them out anyway. Every person is getting a printed paper ballot. So why is it any more or less expensive? You know, the quantity of paper is identical because whether you're voting absentee or you're voting in person, you're getting a paper ballot. So why not just print it out? But again, this is part of, you know, I refer to it as the charade. It's the charade of voting. The idea is that we want to make everyone feel that they voted and feel that their vote was counted and that it's available for a recount in those places that want to be able to do that. Now, a lot of the laws...
The voting ritual.
No, go ahead.
The voting ritual is what...
Voting ritual. Okay, the voting ritual rather than the voting charade. Yeah, the voting ritual. Yeah, and I think you're right. It is really a ritual, but there are some states like California, for example, where there are laws on the books that precede the more recent laws, but don't preempt them. I was involved in a case, this is again, well before Bush versus Gore, but it was in Orange County. And in that particular case, there were two candidates, both of whom had the same last name. And so there was a lot of confusion. One was a gal, one was a guy, they weren't related, but it was a common last name in that area. So there were seven paper ballots so basically these were ballots that were being scanned. They were scanned by a scanner. So people were preparing them by hand, but then they were scanned. And what happened was that there were seven ballots on which there were scribbles. On one, someone had drawn a nice looking flower. I mean, it was really very strange. And the judge did not really want us to be able, us or the, you know, the people who were on the side that I was testifying for, they didn't want all of the ballots to be able to be checked. Only just those seven could be checked as to whether it was a proper ballot or an improper ballot. So that was a situation where we were trying to demand a hand count, a manual count of all of the ballots, but the judge wouldn't let us do that. I was dealing with that judge on a later case, and that was interesting too. But go ahead, Wendy.
Well, one of the interesting things about this is the credence people put in the results they get out of a machine. And this has become a big issue in Britain because you may have heard of the big Horizon post office scandal. This was a system that was in use by they brought in a computer, Fujitsu developed a computer system for sub-postmasters. And it started returning inaccurate results. And the result was that hundreds of these people got demands to make good the quote, non-existent losses the computer system was claiming that they had. And some of them went to jail and a couple committed suicide, and it has all turned out that the computer system was faulty. But under British law, there is this law that says that machine results are treated as infallible. And what that dates back to is things like speed guns on motorways and stuff. You don't want every single motorway speeding case to be challenged and have to prove every single time software that the radar gun actually did the job it was supposed to be able to do. And unfortunately, when computers came in, the law wasn't updated. So there's a lot of discussion now about how to update the law so that it allows for the fact that computer systems cannot possibly be infallible. But that's a big issue in what you're talking about.
Right.
And also in the forensic work that you've been doing more recently.
Right. 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 So in 2004, I had been doing forensic work in the late 1990s, but in 2004, I changed my company, Notable Software. We were originally an Apple certified developer back in the late 80s, but I changed the entire scope of the company to primarily be digital forensics. So I do a lot of work that involves criminal defense, but also some cases that are, you know, it could be, you know, any sort of thing with digital issues. Could be copyrights or, you know, business disputes, whatever. So that's basically what I do. And with that, you have to have provability. There has to be some way of demonstrating that what's being claimed against a defendant or, you know, in a court case, that you can prove that they were the initiator of, you know, the software or whatever, you know. So it's just a lot of different digital work. I do a lot of stuff with phones using triangulation to see if a person actually was in a location when they're being claimed to have been there for nefarious purposes or otherwise. So that was basically what I've been doing for like the last 20 years, essentially full time. But it, you know, it basically relies on the same type of thing, provability. How do you demonstrate that this evidence, which is really digital, is truly accurate and it hasn't been modified or altered in any way or incorrect to begin with, which is sort of what I'm saying with the voting systems.
Yeah, it was a big problem with, I think, with the Horizon case and probably with others in Britain also.
Right.
That, you know, it's a very brittle system in that they didn't have an audit trail where they could go back and see all the transactions and find the error. It was just sort of here, you're missing £1,000.
You know? Right, where did it go? Yeah, exactly.
And you know, the British government is, and I think other governments too, are beginning to bring in systems where, in the UK, it's applying to immigration, where you used to get a physical, you know, you'd get a piece of paper or something that said you have a valid residence visa, or you'd have something stuck in your passport or whatever. And what they're trying to do now is make it an online real-time system, so that if you're applying for a job, your employer can, you go and you tell the system that you need what they call a share code, and you give the prospective employer the share code, and he puts that in, and he can see that your status is valid. And this is going to apply to travel and things. And can you imagine sitting in you arrive at an airport and they can't reach the British computer system to try to verify that you have the right to get on the plane and go to Britain.
Right. And look at the CrowdStrike problem and, you know, all sorts of things like that. And also what's going on, or maybe going on, they haven't started it going on yet, but in the United States with, you know, who's allowed to be here and who's going to be thrown out of the country. So yeah, all of this, you know, who knows, you know, how is it going to be controlled? How can it be secured? How can we make sure that it's all correct? You know, having at least that physical passport, at least until somebody takes it from you, you at least have that piece of evidence that you're able to show. But I think a lot of this is just going to be up in the air. I think, you know, it applies to a whole bunch of different things. I gave a talk earlier this month at the University of Maryland School of Business in their financial information security conference, and really was talking primarily about CrowdStrike, that whole CrowdStrike issue with the, you know, with the flights not being able to, people couldn't get ticketed and stuff like that, and everything being grounded and all. But that itself is part of a bigger issue, which I refer to as cyber monocultures. When you have a particular software that is being used now, not just in, you know, one particular company or one organization or even one type of thing, but it's being used globally. And so it could take everything down, and it's ubiquitous. So it's like, you know, everybody is using this particular piece of software. And so, you know, this was, you know, as it turned out, Microsoft and, you know, this Azure, which it rides on top of, you know, they've now sort of said that, you know, there was an error and then it propagated. But, you know, these updates are occurring so quickly now, and you have to hope and pray that they all, you know, go well and that there aren't any bugs in them, because when they go out to everybody, it's not like a phased in thing. Obviously, they're hopefully testing it at their location first really well before they launch it. But a lot of these updates, you know, for some of this ubiquitous software is just, they're going out multiple times per day. It's not just like once a week or once a month or just to Korea or whatever, you know, it's going everywhere, you know, it's all over the entire globe. So I'm referring to this as cyber monocultures, is that we've created this situation now where the whole world is very vulnerable with respect to these issues, these updates, particular type of software, you know, hacking or whatever. But you know, it's now a problem that everybody has to deal with, and you know, okay, it's still rare. At the time when that went down with the airlines, it also turns out that same software was being used by automobile mechanics to order parts. So again, that was like, it's infrastructure. So here's all these people with broken cars and they need, you know, a new valve or something, but nobody could get anything. It was also for a few weeks before that got resolved. So this is like the new world. This is where we're at. And I don't think people are taking the problem and the issue of cyber monoculture. I don't think they even think of it as cyber monocultures, but they are. And or you can even call them macrocultures. But I think
one issue is that there you have like variations in all the various systems. So you have the single piece of software, but it's running and an extremely variable set of systems. And in testing, you can't always account for the ecosystem that the software is running in one particular place.
That's correct. That too. Yes. So all of these, right. All of this, and when anything just becomes ubiquitous, then whatever it's on, you know, mostly what you saw, because when anything like that happens, I'm always very interested. I just like, you know, stake myself out at my computer for a couple of days and start downloading all information that I'm receiving. So I found pictures of the, you know, the blue screen of death and, you know, the frowny face and all sorts of stuff like that. But so you could see what was being run sort of, or you could sort of intuit it from the way the screens look. But yeah, I mean, that's right. What you're saying is right. But I think people are not really thinking of that. But you know, even getting back to voting machines. So, you know, we don't have one ubiquitous type of voting system, but the big companies that were there even before the Hanging Chad, ES&S, you know, a couple, you know, election system and software, a number of the big companies, they pretty much still control the market for a lot of the software that's being used, whether it's being used to create paper ballots or whether it's being used in as actual voting machines, different types of things, but it's very closely held. Some of these same companies have been around for, you know, since many, many, many decades, well into the last century. So
how trustworthy are these voting machines? I mean, I've heard people concerned that someone could modify a machine that is in use everywhere to make it do what it wasn't intended to do, to change a vote, to erase a vote. Is that a concern to you?
Well, again, when, you know, people were first starting to become concerned about this, when there was this shift away from the lever machines and the punch cards, and the Help America Vote Act basically stimulated the entire United States to switch over into a more automated systems. That's when we went to the touchscreens and we were seeing, it was just literally a touchscreen that you would put your vote on. Nothing got printed out. It would just whisk away inside of the computer. So there are a lot of various hacker conferences and things like that. Princeton University, among them, they'd set up these challenges, see if you can hack the voting machine. And they did. People were able to hack it, but it depends upon access. So one of the things the Princeton University students found was that if you go to hotels in the United States, some of them have like a little lockbox with a key. You can put your stuff in there. A number of these chains use the same key in every hotel room. It's not really very safe, but people don't know that. So they think it's okay. Oh, I'm locking my stuff in there. So that same key was actually the same key that was used with one of the brands of voting systems. I believe it was the Sequoia voting systems. So they didn't even bother to create separate keys. And as a poll worker, they go through this whole thing about locking up the machines and making sure that we put these little tie ties on them and they have to be, all specially, done correctly. But, I try not to laugh when we're there doing that at the end of election day, because it's just utter nonsense. So, and now there is also some voting machines that could actually have internet connections. It sort of bothers me a lot. They claim there's no internet connection in the machines that the voters vote on in my area in New Jersey and other areas that have this particular style of machine, but there's like a electronic poll book. So when the person comes up, they come in, unless they voted absentee, then they would get a paper ballot, which is what I always do. But they come in, and then we have to find out which precinct in our in our room that we have. We usually have three precincts in there. So you have to send them to the right precinct. And then there's like a little tablet that will display just that precinct's voters. So they give us their name and we look it up in there. And then we have to sort of spin it around. We confirm it. They have to do a signature. We flip it back around and we compare their signature to the signature that has been recorded probably when they originally voted. So it may look rather different from what their signature still looks like now if they're still living in the same location. So there is that. And that is entirely internet. It's all being done by the internet. So that information is not on the device. When we come in as a poll worker, we're logging into the internet. And when they originally got this system, it was a massive failure because there was this huge crash, wherever it was going to get the information. And it was just a disaster. And they have no paper backup of these polling books. We used to have a big paper polling book and we would get the voter to sign next to their name and we would confirm that it looked the same as the way it was on the polling book. But it's all electronic now. And that part is definitely done via the internet. So if somebody wanted to jam the works at these polling places that are using these devices, if they somehow managed to defeat the internet connection, then everybody would just be standing there in these humongous long lines. And I don't know that there is necessarily a backup way of doing this because we no longer have electronic poll books. So you just have to pray that on election day, everything's going to work and we'll be able to register the voters. They in the training, they give us no alternate. I don't really know what actually would happen if there was a massive outage or, somebody jamming the poll book thing, because you don't get your authorization to vote. It has to be printed out on a little slip of paper. After we confirm them, a little slip of paper shoots out and we give that to them and they walk over to the voting machine. And then that is separately opened via like a key card that only the poll worker can use to enter that to open that for that one person. That goes on the other side of the room.
You're making me very happy that I vote absentee because
me too.
I get a paper ballot. I mark it up. This year I was actually, I vote from the last place I lived in the States, which is in New York State. And I happened to be in town a couple of weeks before the election, and I hand delivered my
You can
paper
take it.
Ballot.
Yeah, that's great. That's the way. Yeah.
And the woman who had to verify I was who I said I was, I had actually exchanged email with personally. So it was you know, perfect security, but it doesn't
scale.
Perfect
security. Yeah.
But it doesn't scale.
Right.
You could not do that for 360 million people.
Well, you could, but I mean, there are some states that everybody just votes absentee. Oregon is one of them. So yeah. That is their whole state does that. And we have lock boxes. So I never put mine in the mail. You could mail it, but you know, there's all sorts of issues about that. You know, are they being held back or what? If they get lost or whatever. So we now have these big lock boxes in secure locations, usually near or in where an election, a part of the government elections are, or a municipal building or something like that. So it's so like where the Board of Elections is, there's one. Where my township building is, there's one. So there's places where you could physically go. So that's where I always drop mine there, thinking that it's probably safer than putting it in the mail.
You know, thinking more broadly about this, I mean, I don't think we're going to get away from not exactly a monoculture, but call it an oligoculture, where we have a few, we have Windows, Mac, and Linux, and Android. You know, I don't think we're going to get away too far from the operating systems we have, because each one has its place. And there's not a lot of benefit to most people to having an operating system or software that you can't hire somebody to fix because nobody else uses it. You know, there are reasons why we have sort of coalesced around this small number of things. So how do we, you know, you were talking about the problem of monocultures. So how do we, you know, how do we make the world, we're building a world without a backup. We're building an online,
yes.
Electronic, we're electronifying all of society without a backup. So how do we make it more reliable and more secure? What do we do?
That's a good question. I think it's a scary situation that we're entering into. I think that some businesses and some individual humans will create their own ways of backing up things, whether those will be reliable or not when the time comes to need them, we don't know. There is still Linux and other, you know, open source types of things which could be used for certain things. So even though you're riding on Microsoft or Apple or whatever, you could still be using the software tools that you can actually get into and actually see what's going on should you be so inclined to do that. And then having them those tools being more ubiquitous, the format of those outputs would be also movable between the different types of systems. To me, I look at you know, what files I'm creating. So whether it be a CSV file or a PDF or whatever. So if there's multiple different ways to access that, I'm still okay no matter what operating system I'm using. So I guess I think of it that way.
When it's harder to do that when as so often we're actually having to do things with someone else's system that we don't really control, but
right.
That have quite a lot of power over our lives. And I mean, the thing, you know, the thing of the immigration thing that the UK is doing is very scary to me. I mean, because I can really imagine being one of those people and being stuck. And I mean, this week I went to a play last night, and when I first went to download the tickets, I accidentally didn't realize that I would not be able to, what I wanted was something I could print out. What I got was something I could display on my mobile phone, and I couldn't go back and make the other choice.
Oh, you couldn't get the other choice.
I couldn't get the tickets to display on my mobile phone. So in the end, I took pictures of the computer screen. because it, you know, it was a QR code. So I took a pictures of the two tickets, the QR codes, and I took it to the theater, and it actually worked.
Right. But it's getting worse. This is.
But how many people think of that?
Right. This is all getting much, much, much worse. And then this whole weirdness of like the double authentication with your various passwords, or it has to be your phone, or it has to be your email address. And I got locked out of my Zoom account. I have my own Zoom account, so I can create Zooms. I got locked out of my Zoom account, and it took me 2 hours texting with the Zoom people because they don't talk. They're humans, some of them, I believe. But
it's like we have nothing else to do except serve these computers.
Right, right, exactly. And so 2 hours of doing this, and I missed an appointment, and it, you know, people were mad at me. Some people are mad at me even still. So it just, you know, this is no way to live. We can't live like this. We're also reliant on our cell phones now, but yet there's no proper ways to back those up either. They're up in the cloud, but what happens if the cloud is inaccessible, or what happens if the cloud gets destroyed? I mean, you know, okay,
yeah, there's,
but in the cloud.
There's this whole thing of the passkey. So you can create passkeys now, which may be biometric or whatever. But the question is, how are you going to do that? Where are you going to store it? Is it going to be like, I mean, one ideal way to do it might be facial recognition on your iPhone or on your smartphone. But, you know, the question is, it seems like there are variations offered of pass keys, and they're inconsistent variations. You know, it's like it's like they kind of don't have their act together about what a pass key really is and what you can really use as a pass key. It's driving me a little bit crazy now, because theoretically I'd like to be able to create pass keys for accounts, and there are accounts that support them. But when you go to create a pass key, it can get very confusing. And you have this question about whether you can access the pass key again when you actually need it.
Right. And that's what I'm seeing also. And I've already experienced some of that too. So, you know, despite keeping on pieces of paper, log sheets of, you know, what these things are, which is so bogus, because if someone gets this piece of paper, then they have all the passkeys. But then if we make them faces or whatever, then we won't even have that. So yeah, it's just becoming a complete nightmare. And I think it's just, they're adding more layers of this type of authentication, you know, two-party authentication, blah, 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 blah. You know, it just keeps getting, you know, this bigger and bigger nest of stuff, and it's not going to work. It already doesn't work. But
the other, you know, the other thing is, when you're dealing with a large organization like a government or a bank, they assume you need to be authenticated because you might be a fraudster, but they never think that they need to be authenticated. They behave like A-list celebrities, you know.
Right
And
exactly.
It's maddening, you know, because you should always have a two-way handshake,
right? And this is only going to get worse. I mean, it's going to get much worse before it gets any better.
I saw a description of a scam the other day where some organization or group of people represented themselves as being Chase Bank. And they contacted somebody who had a Chase Bank account, and they strung him along. And he was like a security expert or something.
What?
And he was completely taken in. He didn't quite get to the point where he handed all of his keys over to him, but he got pretty close. And the thing is that it was a very sophisticated structure that they offered. It's like, you know, they called sounding very official and very professional, and they pretended to be doing a fraud investigation, and they called back multiple times, each time a little bit farther into the investigation. They had the whole thing sort of laid out so that it was very believable to this guy.
Yeah.
And if he hadn't been a security professional, he might not have caught him, you know, because eventually he figured it out.
Yeah. There's been a couple of times when I've been really close to being fooled, and I always call it the smell test. Sometimes I'm just like, you know, something's telling you don't hit that key, or don't, you know, just hang up.
How about this? I once got a phone call from a guy who said he was a policeman and he was in Selfridge's department store, which is a very fancy
Selfridge's,
department store.
Yes, my mom
said. Did I know where my credit cards were? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, could you go check? Because there's somebody here with the credit card that belongs to you. And I'm sitting thinking, now, hang on. What are the odds that a policeman has gone to look me up in a phone, looked up my name in a phone book and found my number and is calling me to tell me somebody is trying to pass, use my credit card fraudulently?
Wow.
So I said, yeah, well, I know where my credit cards are. And he said, well, I really wish you'd check. And I said, well, what bank is the card from? And he said, Lloyd's Bank, which is one of the top four or five banks. And I said, nope, but thank you for playing. And I hung up.
Well, the latest big scam that's being done with AI is a voice impersonation. And they had an incident where a person got a call from what sounded like their son saying that he was in big trouble and he needed money to be bailed out right away. And that's what concerns me about any biometric identifier. It's like, how easy is it to fake it?
Yeah. Yeah. There had been this one with, you know, your grandson or whatever, you know, but that was, it wasn't the actual voice, but wow, I hadn't heard about this yet. But yeah. Yeah. They can just sample people's voices and now they've got, and you can find people, you know, like people are on TikTok or whatever. You can grab their voices or whatever anywhere. So you're right. It's very, very dangerous. So, wow.
Say, I hate to say this, but we are actually at the end of our hour.
No, already?
And this has been a fantastic conversation. Yes, can you come back sometime?
Oh, absolutely. It was an exciting conversation. We got through a lot of topics.
Let's do it again then.
Yeah, it was really great. So, yeah, and people can go to my website, notablesoftware.com. That has all of my materials on it, and you can just find all the stuff that I talked about. So that'd be great.
Okay, and we'll put that up and any other links that you want to on our website at plutopia.io. If people are accessing this through YouTube or as a podcast, look at plutopia.io to see links and stuff like that. And to give us money, you know, if you want to, that would be good too. Thanks so much.
Thank
you.
Nice to meet with all of
you. Yeah, it's been a great, great talk.
Thank you for arranging it, Wendy. Take care.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.